Good afternoon, and welcome to Public Health Grand Rounds. I'm Rebecca Parkin. I'm an Associate Dean in the School of Public Health and Health Services here at GW. Dean Katz usually opens these events, but she's unable to be here today, and she asked that I extend her regrets to you and add her personal welcome to you all. This is the eighth session of this year's Grand Rounds. This series is open to anyone who wants to attend. I see that in the audience today, we have public health practitioners, the public, students, faculty, and staff of the health, public health, medical, and other schools across GW. Together, you represent a cross-section of people who recognize the relevance of public health in your own lives and in your work. Thank you for coming. Today's event is co-sponsored with the Jacobs Institute of Women's Health. As some of you know, the Jacobs Institute is a pioneer in women's health, with a particularly strong track record in the areas of maternal health, cardiovascular disease, managed care, health disparities, and quality of care. The Institute officially became part of the school in 2006, and this program is just one of the fruits of the partnership that we expect to grow even more in coming years. Grand Rounds this year is built around the theme of translating science into public health policy, the underlying reason for most of the research at our school. Our goal in creating knowledge is to help make the world a better place by building on what we discover to shape public health policy and inform the law, identify best practices, and influence the structure and financing of the healthcare system. Over the past year, the speakers who have accepted our invitation to Grand Rounds have touched on many of the major topics confronting our society in public health. Julie Gerberding, the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, opened this year's series by exploring health policy and politics. And just a few weeks ago, Dr. Kevin DeCock, who directs the Department of HIV/AIDS at the World Health Organization, described the challenges of the maturing HIV epidemic. In other sessions, national experts have explored health disparities, decision-making in the face of uncertainty, and the importance of physical activity. Each speaker has been informative and thought-provoking, and I know that our guest today, Dr. Gita Rao Gupta, will be no different. Dr. Gupta, president of the International Center for Research on Women, is internationally known for her groundbreaking efforts to bring attention to the vulnerability of women to HIV. As we get started, I'd like to express my gratitude to Pfizer for the support that makes Grand Rounds possible. Without Dr. DeBono, who has been Pfizer's champion for this series, it simply would not be possible to run this series. We're also indebted to the Kaiser Family Foundation for helping us to webcast and podcast this entire series so that we can share the series with a much wider audience. Thanks to the Foundation's generosity, you can download any Grand Rounds event you wish with a click from the school's website. Our last Grand Rounds event this year will kick off National Public Health Week. On Monday, April 7th, at noon in this auditorium, Dr. Christine Ebi will be speaking to us about global climate change and public health, this year's theme for National Public Health Week. And now it's my very great pleasure to turn the microphone over to Dr. Amita Vyas of the Department of Prevention and Community Health, who will introduce today's speaker. Amita?
It is with great pleasure today that I introduce our speaker this afternoon. Dr. Gita Rao Gupta is the president for the International Center for Research on Women, which is an international nonprofit organization based here in Washington, D.C. They focus on empowering women, advancing gender equality, and fighting poverty in the developing world. Dr. Rao Gupta is an internationally renowned expert on women and HIV/AIDS. She has spearheaded groundbreaking research in 15 countries exploring factors that fuel the spread of HIV/AIDS among women. She is a longtime advocate for economic and social empowerment to prevent the spread of HIV/AIDS, and she delivered the plenary session at the 13th World AIDS Conference at Durban, South Africa. Apart from her work on HIV/AIDS, Dr. Rao Gupta is also known as a dynamic speaker and educator on adolescent sexuality and fertility, the unmet need for family planning, adolescent and maternal nutrition, and other health-related subjects affecting women and girls. She served as co-chair of the UN Secretary General's High-Level Panel on Youth Employment and co-chaired the UN Millennium Project's Task Force on Promoting Gender Equality and Empowering Women. She has received a number of awards, most recently the Anne Rowe Award from the Harvard Graduate School of Education and the Working Mother Media Legacy Award. I have often heard of Dr. Geeta Rao Gupta as being referred to as a pioneer, and that she certainly is. She's not only a role model for the millions of girls and women she has advocated for and helped through her professional work, but a role model for young women around the world when it comes to raising a family, being an activist and a leader, and pursuing such a successful career in public health. Today, it is both a professional and a personal honor for me to introduce Dr. Geeta Rao Gupta.
Thank you so very much. Good afternoon to you all. And that was such a generous introduction. It's the kind of introduction where you wish your parents were sitting in the room. It's a pleasure to be here. I get so bogged down with management these days, I rarely get the opportunity to give technical talks, so this is a particular pleasure. I'm going to focus my talk, as this slide shows, on structural approaches to HIV prevention, focusing in on the lessons learned from addressing gender inequality, which is one of the biggest structural barriers in the HIV/AIDS epidemic. And as you all probably know, the fundamental goal of all HIV prevention is changing behavior to prevent HIV transmission. But over the last quarter century, efforts in prevention to change behavior have been marked by countless questions and controversies. Sensitivities with regard to sex and drug use, combined with hostility and fear of the marginalized populations that are at greatest risk, such as sex workers and drug users and gay men, have mired the field with ideological battles and controversies, many of which I'm sure you've been following in the Washington Post. While there have been notable country successes, recent years have witnessed an increase in risk behaviors in the very settings in which HIV prevention successes were first documented, calling into question the sustainability of behavior shifts. And yet, the urgency of the epidemic remains. Despite the recent downward adjustment by UNAIDS of the global figures on HIV prevalence, as of December 2007, an estimated 33.2 million people worldwide are living with HIV, including 2.5 million of whom contracted HIV in the previous 12 months. Nearly 70% of those living with HIV live in sub-Saharan Africa, where in many countries, adult HIV prevalence rates exceed 15%, creating conditions for an alarmingly high risk of transmission. And as is well documented, almost 61% of adults living with HIV in that region are women. More startling is the fact that in some parts of sub-Saharan Africa, particularly Southern Africa, three-fourths of 15 to 24-year-olds who are infected with HIV are young women, a gender disparity that is troubling but seems to be declining, seems to be showing some response in countries such as Botswana, Kenya, and Malawi, where HIV prevalence rates among that age group are in fact plateauing. In countries outside of that region, the epidemic is more concentrated in particular populations, and the ratio of women to men has remained relatively stable over time, though the numbers infected overall continue to gradually increase. An analysis of the successes so far and the lessons learned from past attempts to change behavior clearly show that although individual behavior change programs should have an important place in an HIV prevention package, they are unlikely by themselves to achieve the level of success needed to reverse the epidemic. So they are necessary but not sufficient, particularly in places like sub-Saharan Africa. To bring about meaningful reductions in HIV will require population-wide changes in the structures, social, political, and economic, that shape and constrain individual behavior. To make a dent in the sexual transmission of HIV in Africa, for example, it is now widely recognized that it will be necessary to change the social norms that support concurrent sexual partnerships and gender inequality. The recognition of the importance of structural factors has led to a number of efforts to move beyond individual level models of prevention. These efforts, commonly referred to as structural approaches, seek to change both the broader context that increases individuals' vulnerability and the more immediate context that contributes to individuals' risk. Poverty and wealth, gender and age, policy and power, migration and stigma are just a few of the many structural factors that contribute to vulnerability and risk that structural approaches seek to address. Examples of structural approaches range from simple fixes to more complex transformative processes. A policy that permits the distribution of clean needles, for example, is well-researched and proven and a relatively simple structural way to reduce the transmission of HIV through injecting drug use. While the provision of a bus service to take girls to school in order to reduce the likelihood that they will be sexually exploited by older men who give them rides to school is a fairly simple way of a structural approach to reduce girls' vulnerability to HIV through transactional sex. Other structural efforts are more complex and long-term, with social transformation as their intent. Working with young men and women, for example, to change the social norms that define masculinity and femininity in order to promote more gender equitable relationships is an example of transformative structural approach. The defining characteristic of all structural approaches, the common thread in a sense, is that they attempt to change the underlying cause or the root cause or the underlying driver or the contextual correlate, whether that's social, physical, political, economic, institutional, that fosters HIV vulnerability and risk. Although the limited success of individual behavior interventions has created a longing for effective ways to address the deeper, more pervasive factors that undermine prevention efforts, progress in adopting structural approaches as a central part of mainstream HIV prevention has been stymied for the most part, and due to a number of factors. These include a lack of clarity on how structural factors contribute to risk and vulnerability, less than clear direction on how to implement structural approaches, and confusion on the best way to determine the effectiveness of such approaches. And I'll add a fourth, which is the tension that exists in the field of HIV/AIDS between the biomedical paradigm that has dominated the world of HIV prevention, that demands cause and effect relationships, as opposed to a social science approach that that is sort of looser and requires and involves more sort of multiple causal pathways that are more difficult to identify through biomedical methodologies. Those are the reasons why this field has been held back, and you should know that there is a determined attempt right now to push that field forward. The Lancet is issuing a special issue on prevention for the Mexico City International AIDS Conference, in which there will be a paper on structural approaches and how to move the field forward. So in my talk today, I will address some of those factors that have held the field back, using the example of gender inequality as a structural factor that increases both men's and women's vulnerability to HIV infection. In doing so, I just want to mention, I will restrict myself to the sexual transmission of HIV. And although gendered structures in society shape outcomes for both women and men, for the most part, I will restrict my remarks to the implications for women, primarily because that is what I know best. Most of what I say comes from empirical research conducted over the last 15 years, including but not limited to the findings of a large program that ICRW undertook called the Women and AIDS Research Program, which was funded by USAID and supported 17 studies across 13 different countries in the developing world during the period 1990 to 1997. And I mention that only to tell you that by the end of that program in 1997, we knew fully well what needed to be done, that we needed a structured approach. And here we are in 2008, still trying to move that field forward. Based on those findings of that program and others, what I will try to create for you this afternoon is a conceptual map on how various research findings have led us down a particular path and helped to shape the structural approach to HIV vulnerability caused by gender inequality. And then I'll present to you a framework for action and finally conclude with some thoughts on what is needed to move the field of structural approaches forward. So let's begin by tracing how the structural factor of gender inequality contributes to HIV risk and vulnerability. Let's begin with just a definition of gender because it's often a confusing term. It's a culture-specific construct. There are specific, significant differences in what women and men can or cannot do in one culture as compared to another. And while that difference is more pronounced in some cultures, there's almost always a distinct difference between women's and men's roles, obligations, and privileges, particularly in terms of access to productive resources and decision-making authority. In most societies, gender norms dictate that men are responsible for the productive activities outside the home, while women are expected to be responsible for the reproductive and productive activities within the home. And we know from over 25 years of research on women's roles in development that women have less access to and control of productive resources than men, as evidenced through persistent gender gaps in education, employment, income, ownership of land and housing, and access to credit. In interaction with sexuality, gender inequality greatly undermines women's ability to protect themselves from infection. Sexuality is distinct from gender and yet intimately linked to it. It is the social construction of a biological drive. And an individual's sexuality is defined in the simplest terms by whom one has sex with, in what ways, why, under what circumstances, and with what outcomes. It is more than sexual behavior. It is a multidimensional and dynamic concept. Explicit and implicit rules imposed by society, as defined by one's gender, age, socioeconomic status, ethnicity, and other factors, influence an individual's sexuality and sexual expression. Predictably, the inequality that characterizes the social and economic spheres of society between women and men, in which women have less access to productive resources than men, is often mirrored in sexual interactions, creating an unequal balance of power in sexual relationships. As a result, many women have less control than men over when, where, why, and with whom, and how sex takes place. This inequality in sexual decision-making is perpetuated by gender norms of femininity and masculinity that curtail women's sexual autonomy and expand men's sexual privilege, place greater emphasis on male pleasure over female pleasure, and cast women in the role of passive recipient rather than active actor. The complex interplay of social and economic gender differences and inequalities, combined with the unequal balance of power in sexual relations that favors men, significantly increases both women's and men's vulnerability in the epidemic. For adolescent girls, this inequality and the impact of gender norms is further compounded by age. Because in most societies, the young are granted less power in shaping their own destinies than their older counterparts, adolescent girls are sort of figuratively speaking, at the bottom of the totem pole, just when they are experiencing key life transitions, such as marriage and initiation into sexual activity, often with older men, as well as motherhood. As a result, age and gender interact to increase the vulnerabilities that make HIV infection more likely for females in both adolescence and in early adulthood. There are five gender-related factors that emerge from the research over the past almost 15 years now that contribute to women's and girls' vulnerability to HIV infection, and I'd like to go through them one by one with you. First is prevailing norms of femininity, and of course the parallel to that are the prevailing norms of masculinity that I'm not going to go into here today, but let's just look at the prevailing norms of femininity that promote, and this is broad generalization to create a picture, ignorance, passivity, and acceptance among women, and thereby creating a foundation for women's vulnerability to HIV. In many societies, there is a culture of silence that surrounds sex that dictates that good women are expected to be ignorant about sex and passive in sexual interactions. This makes it difficult for women to be informed about risk reduction or to be proactive in negotiating safer sex. The traditional norm of virginity for unmarried girls, while protective of infection in most instances, could and does increase young women's risk of infection if it restricts their ability to ask for information about sex out of fear of the negative sanctions that might result. Virginity has also been known to put young girls at risk of rape and sexual coercion in some settings because of the erroneous belief that sex with a virgin can cleanse a man of HIV infection. In addition, research has shown that some young women practice alternative sexual behaviors, such as anal sex, in order to preserve their virginity and protect against unwanted pregnancy, although these behaviors, as we know, place them at increased risk of HIV. And finally, in many cultures, because motherhood, like virginity, is considered to be a feminine ideal, using barrier methods of contraception, such as the condom, which is the one and only prevention method that we have, presents a significant dilemma for women, particularly young women who are newly married. Second, education and information. Gender gaps in education, which favor boys in most regions of the world and persist at both the primary and secondary school level, though much more significantly at the secondary school level, also increase women's and girls' vulnerability. Although in the early years of the epidemic, there was a positive correlation between education and HIV infection, meaning those who were more educated were more likely to be infected, a recent review of literature by ActionAid showed that in countries with a high prevalence of HIV, there is now a strong negative correlation between the number of years of schooling and HIV prevalence. The persistent gender gaps in secondary education for girls in particular are of grave concern because recent analysis showed a stronger association of completion of secondary education with lower HIV risk, more condom use, and fewer sexual partners as compared to those who had a primary education. The same review also showed that females who received more education were more likely to start having sex at a later age. So sexual debut is also influenced by being in school. The next one is information. Limited access to comprehensive information on sex and HIV prevention further compounds women's and girls' risk. Because of the culture of silence that surrounds sex that I just mentioned, women and girls, particularly unmarried girls, are often uninformed about sexual matters. A study in Southeast Nigeria, for example, found that the stigma attached to premarital sex limited the availability of and access to contraceptive information and services by single women. And an analysis of data from 23 developing countries found that levels of knowledge about HIV and AIDS are almost always higher among men than among women, with 75% of men on average having accurate knowledge of HIV transmission routes and prevention as compared to roughly 65% of women. Fears that providing comprehensive sex education to adolescents may lead to early sexual debut and increased sexual activity have often led to restrictions being imposed, policy restrictions being imposed on the type and level of information on sex and HIV prevention that adolescents receive. Contrary to these fears, a thorough review of 83 countries conducted in developed and developing countries by Douglas Kirby, showed that comprehensive sex education programs that include information on abstinence, contraception, pregnancy, and sexually transmitted infections, including HIV, do not increase sexual activity. In fact, of the 52 studies that specifically looked at initiation of sex, all but one found that programs either delayed sexual initiation or had no impact. Hence, there is little evidence to support the belief that sexuality and or HIV education promote promiscuity. The third factor is women's economic vulnerability and their dependency on men for economic security, which makes it less likely that women will succeed in negotiating condom use or fidelity with a non-monogamous partner. It also makes it less likely that they will leave a relationship that they perceive to be risky because they lack the bargaining power, the economic independence, and they fear abandonment and destitution. Poverty and a lack of economic alternatives have repeatedly been identified as the many reasons, as the reasons that many adult women and children become sex workers. In conditions of extreme poverty, many women and girls fall into sex work either because they are sold or trafficked into the sex industry or feel that they have no other option to economically sustain themselves and their children. Here too, then, women's lack of economic alternatives puts women directly in the path of HIV infection. Fourth, women's lack of access to and control, lack of access to and control over economic assets, such as land and housing, makes them particularly vulnerable to the AIDS epidemic and can fuel a vicious intergenerational cycle of disease and death and poverty. Increasing women's economic security through ownership of and control over land and housing is an AIDS prevention and control strategy because it protects women from complete economic devastation when husbands or fathers fall sick and die of AIDS. Without a guarantee of property and inheritance rights, the woman left behind is at risk of losing her home, inheritance, and possessions, either because of property grabbing, which has now been anecdotally documented in many parts of Africa, by relatives and community members, with no accessible legal recourse to regain ownership of that property. Thrust into these difficult economic situations, women and girls may then be forced into risky and unsafe sexual behaviors just to meet their own and their children's or siblings' basic needs for shelter, food, and clothing, or may fall prey to sexual predators, thereby perpetuating a vicious cycle of HIV infection, disease, and death. Those of you who have traveled to Southern Africa may have visited communities where there are bands of orphans just living together or children-headed households trying to provide for their siblings, where the head of the household is sometimes 10 or 11 years old. And you can imagine if they don't have a roof over their heads and are living out in the open, how they can be so easily sexually exploited. It has also been known anecdotally for many years that control over land and housing can give women greater bargaining power within households, which may translate into greater leverage to negotiate HIV prevention behaviors, though this relationship is currently being tested by ICRW through studies in both India and South Africa. Control over land and housing in some circumstances, however, does protect against the risk of domestic violence, thereby indirectly reducing vulnerability to HIV. Research in Kerala, India, found that 49% of women with no property ownership reported physical violence within the home, compared to only 7% of women who owned property. We haven't been able to determine what the cause and the effect is, but there is a very strong association, which since then ICRW has found in studies in Sri Lanka, in the western part of India, and in Bangladesh. And yet we know that there are still many countries in which women do not have the right to own or inherit land and property, and even when such laws exist, most land and property is owned by men because of the poor enforcement of the laws or because of a conflict between statutory laws and customary laws. And then let's come to the next related factor, which is violence against women. In a WHO-sponsored multi-country study, data from more than 24,000 women interviewed in 15 sites in 10 countries revealed that domestic violence, that 15 to 71% of women reported having experienced physical and or sexual violence by an intimate partner. Now, that's a broad range. The majority of countries range somewhere between 30 to 40%. Women living in rural settings in Bangladesh, Peru, Ethiopia, and Tanzania reported the greatest levels of violence. And this was true even in a study that we did in India on 10,000 households. The overall prevalence of domestic violence was 40%. I'm talking about physical violence, not emotional violence. And 50% of those 40% of women said they had experienced it during pregnancy, when women are most vulnerable and therefore violence is most threatening to them. Violence is the most extreme form of gender inequality and is a direct result of gender norms that make male violence against women a socially acceptable way to control an intimate partner. Violence contributes both directly and indirectly to women's vulnerability to HIV. Individuals who have been sexually abused are at immediate risk of HIV infection, but they're also more likely to engage in unprotected sex, have multiple partners, and trade sex for money or drugs, is what the research has shown. Data from a Tanzanian study suggests that for some women, the experience of partner violence is a strong predictor, could be a strong predictor of HIV. Suzanne Mammon and colleagues found that among women who sought services at a voluntary counseling and testing center, those who were HIV positive were 2.6 times more likely to have experienced violence in an intimate relationship than those who were HIV negative. A similar association was found among women attending antenatal care clinics in South Africa. After controlling for age, current relationship status, and women's risk behavior, intimate partner violence in South Africa was significantly associated with HIV seropositivity. Although we have known for more than a decade that these particular factors increase women's and girls' vulnerability, that knowledge, unfortunately, and this is my greatest frustration because I have spoken from the podium about these factors for 10 years now, that knowledge has not been translated into large-scale efforts to address women's vulnerability. Instead, for the most part, HIV prevention has been restricted to a traditional package, that alphabet soup of behavior change interventions that have emphasized the A, B, and the C: abstain or delay sexual debut, be faithful or reduce the number of sexual partners, and use condoms consistently and correctly. And that has been often combined with counseling and testing and treatment services as the traditional AIDS package of services. Although these are all essential components of any HIV prevention program and are proven methods to prevent the spread of HIV, they do not always suit women's and girls' needs or daily realities. In fact, many women who have complied with their expected roles, they have married early, become mothers, and remain faithful to their spouses, are becoming infected in larger and larger numbers with HIV. In a study involving 4,500 women in Zimbabwe and South Africa, 40% of women who reported low-risk behaviors were HIV positive. Married adolescent girls may be at particular risk. Data from sub-Saharan Africa show that HIV prevalence tends to be higher among married adolescent girls than their sexually active unmarried peers. For the ABCs to be feasible for and adopted by women, thus requires additional actions, what we have begun to call an ABC plus approach, to create the enabling conditions to make A, B, and C more realistic options for women and girls. In an attempt to clarify the different ways to respond to women's inequalities and vulnerabilities within HIV programming, a few years ago, I developed a framework that distinguishes between four levels of strategies that fall on a continuum of increasing degrees of responsiveness to gender inequality: do no harm, address gender differences, trigger transformations in gender roles and relationships, and empower women and girls. All four can, in fact, be undertaken within AIDS programming as traditionally defined. But the success of the fourth strategy, empowering women and girls, is more effective when implemented together with broader economic and social development actions. This is the rub. This is where we get told all the time that there isn't anything we can do within AIDS programming. What you're talking about, inequalities in education and economic power and so on, is really issues that broader development efforts should be dealing with, and it shouldn't be part of AIDS programming. In an ideal world, if every development issue had the same amount of money, that would be true. If in an ideal world where the epidemic was not racing at the pace that it is at right now, particularly among women and girls, that would be all right. But right now, it is clear to us that some of this programming has to occur within HIV/AIDS programs, and that's the clarity that I was trying to achieve by defining it in this way. So let's go through those four levels. At the most fundamental level, it's do no harm. And that's the most basic but you'll be surprised how much harm is done out there and how important it is to pay attention to this. The best way to do no harm is to base programming on evidence rather than on ideology or on morality. Promoting abstinence-only prevention programs and keeping information on sex and protection away from adolescent girls are the most common examples of doing harm through programming by basing interventions on ideology rather than evidence. Programming that reinforces damaging gender and sexual stereotypes or fosters stigma can also do great harm. Posters in the early years of the epidemic in which a sex worker is portrayed as a skeleton, bringing the risk of death to potential clients, is an example of stigmatizing sex workers that does nothing but drive them underground and, in fact, fuel the epidemic, in addition to increasing their vulnerability to violence and to infection. Another common type of poster, such as the one here, is one that exploits a macho image of men to sell condoms by portraying the man with many women, or in this case, one woman on his side, a wink in his eye, and a condom in his back pocket. This type of marketing approach certainly has the potential to show success on indicators such as the number of condoms sold, but is less likely to succeed in averting infections because it increases the probability of risk by implicitly condoning multiple sexual partnerships among men. I've often said that the very foundation of AIDS prevention is responsible, respectful, mutually satisfying, consensual sex. And in order to have that, you cannot have images like this out there. The worst image I will quickly tell you that I saw was in Cameroon for military recruits of a young soldier dressed in battle fatigues, resting, putting on his battle shoes, with a rifle with a bayonet on the top and the condom on the bayonet. And the message said, just as you prepare for battle, prepare for sex. And it was an empty alcohol bottle lying on the side. And when I talked to the social marketers who had introduced that campaign in Cameroon, I was told that, well, men, you know, like alcohol, they you know, their lives are violent, that's what it's about. And I said, yeah, but you're not selling toothpaste. You're trying to sell a shift in a social norm. And a lot of women get infected because of violence, particularly in times of conflict and war, because of rape. And so if that's the kind of thing, and of course he showed me the graph of the increased condom sales among Army recruits. So I just mentioned that as something we have learned along the way. A second level up is to ensure that AIDS services recognize and respond to gender differences and inequalities, not attempt to change those differences, but just ensure that they're taken into consideration in the design and implementation of services. So it's a very reasonable suggestion. Don't try and shift things if you think that's beyond your realm, but try and at least acknowledge that they exist and address them through the way in which you provide services. So providing women with women-controlled prevention technology, such as a female condom, is an excellent example of such an approach because it doesn't presume to change any power dynamics. It's just saying, well, you know, she can't convince the man to use the condom. She has no control over that. We just give her something she can use. It's a bit of a cop-out, but it's at least one way forward. In the same way, ICAW worked with WHO a few years ago to draft guidelines to show how a range of traditional HIV services, from counseling and testing to treatment services, could be made more gender responsive by incorporating features that respected, for example, women's greater time and money constraints, by finding ways to reduce waiting time and reducing the cost of services, or that predicted women's vulnerability to violence at the time of disclosure of serostatus by helping to mediate the disclosure discussion with other family members and other such suggestions. Making services gender sensitive is necessary to maximize the effectiveness of the investments that we are in any case making in them. This seems to be an easy enough concept to understand if you accept that women and men have different roles and responsibilities in society, and as a result, have differential access to resources and differential constraints. Yet, there are many examples of AIDS programming that still operate in a gender-blind way. The latest example of this is the guidelines developed for rolling out the latest promise for successful prevention, male circumcision. While male circumcision is definitely an intervention that holds enormous promise, it must be and must be made available, I am truly struck by how the current discourse on it tends to completely ignore the social and cultural context of gender relations and sexuality. Without incorporating the implications of that context within the plans for implementation, this new prevention option runs the risk of being less than maximally effective. The third level up goes a step further, to use AIDS programming to trigger transformation in gender roles and relationships, and thereby create more gender equitable relationships. There are at least three ways to do this. First, by linking or integrating HIV and AIDS programs to services that increase women's access to economic and social resources, and thereby greater control over their own destinies. This can be done through linking HIV prevention programs to microfinance programs, or providing women in HIV testing sites with information or resources and services that are available to address domestic violence within the community, or integrating family planning and reproductive health services into HIV/AIDS prevention and treatment services, which I don't know if you've been following, is the latest battle on the Hill with regard to the reauthorization of the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. The civil society advocates have asked for the integration of reproductive health services within treatment services and prevention services of HIV/AIDS, as well as AIDS money being provided to provide HIV testing and prevention services within family planning clinics, and that's where the reauthorization process of that bill for the next 5 years for $50 billion has fallen apart, and the bill hasn't moved forward. There's now a rewriting of it in the Senate that we're hoping will take care of that issue. But it's because of this political battle between family planning and abortion on the one side, so that any reference to integrating reproductive health becomes an issue. So access to such ancillary but essential services can put in place an economically and socially transformative process within a woman's life that ultimately could contribute to equitable relationships. A second way to do this is to provide HIV/AIDS services in a way that actually models equitable relationships. One of the best examples is couple counseling in HIV testing clinics to help couples together as partners deal with the results of their tests and reduce the potential negative impacts of the gender power imbalance because they're both present to hear the results. The findings from research suggest that couple counseling has a powerful impact on prevention behaviors in programs that seek to prevent the transmission of HIV from an infected pregnant woman to her unborn child. Again, although the provision of couple counseling by itself is unlikely to change gender norms, by deliberately fostering partner communication, it may trigger changes in gender norms in the long run. And the third type of gender transformative HIV prevention programming is one that uses community-based participatory processes that allow for critical analysis and reflection to trigger transformations in gender roles and norms. And the last few years have seen a burgeoning, actually, of such efforts, particularly those that focus on changing attitudes and beliefs of men and young boys in communities. And there are two excellent examples. Program H, first developed in Brazil and now adapted for use in India, and Men as Partners, first developed in South Africa. These programs seek to foster constructive roles for men in sexual and reproductive health. The curricula for these programs use a wide range of activities, games, role plays, group discussions to facilitate an examination of gender and sexuality and its impact on gender roles and relationships. Research conducted in Brazil to evaluate Program H found that support for inequitable gender norms had decreased among young men who participated in the program, whereas there was no change in the control group. In addition, increases in condom use at last sex with primary partners and decreases in reported sexually transmitted infections were also reported in the intervention group. And the proportion of young men who believed that there were times when a woman deserves to be beaten dropped from 31% to 14% after the intervention. Similar data were found from evaluations of other such programs, which is basically changes in gender attitudes, beliefs, and even reported behaviors. And finally, the empowering approaches. These strategies aim to address the broader environment that constrains women's behaviors and choices and often require programming in ways that are different from the typical components of ABC programming. Empowering approaches are critical to reinforcing women's ability to protect themselves and take charge of their own destiny so that they can be active agents in using a range of resources to bring about positive changes in the outcomes of their lives. Women's access to these resources can be increased for policies that are gender equitable, so you could have a legislative intervention, structural intervention, or through programs that foster women's participation and decision-making. There are two programs, and I'll see if I have time for both. Maybe I'll have time for just one. The IMAGE Project in South Africa and the Sonagachi Project for Sex Workers in Calcutta in India that illustrate the feasibility of empowering women through programs and processes that address important structural and contextual barriers, namely partner violence, limited or lack of social capital, and economic vulnerability. Both programs provided women with needed resources and did so by using a process that was empowering, which showed measurable results in terms of their vulnerability to HIV. Let's go through the IMAGE project, which stands for the Intervention with Microfinance for AIDS and Gender Equity, which highlights the feasibility and impact of combining interventions that address individual and contextual barriers to behavior change with actions to stimulate community responses to foster an enabling environment. So there's specific services provided, but there's also community processes that they put in place to create an enabling environment for change. This initiative provided microloans to women and integrated a 10-part gender and HIV training program called Sisters for Life into fortnightly loan repayment meetings over a six-month period. More importantly, the IMAGE project mobilized microfinance participants who tended to be older women in the community to be agents of change in their households and communities. Using a randomized cluster design, the researchers found that after 2 years, those in the intervention group compared to the control group matched for age and poverty status experienced greater improvements in assets, expenditures, and membership in informal savings groups. The intervention group also demonstrated a consistent pattern of improvement in 9 indicators of empowerment, including autonomy in decision-making, relationships with partners, challenging gender norms, and participation in collective action. Indeed, as proof of the empowerment of the women in the intervention group, IMAGE participants organized over 60 community events that addressed HIV, violence, rape, and abuse, and that engaged traditional leaders, the police, school principals, so clearly a very effective community mobilization campaign. The study also found that although the intervention did not show a reduction in HIV incidence among participants, the risk of physical and or sexual intimate partner violence dropped by 55% in that period of time. And then just very quickly, the Sonagachi Project, I don't know if you've heard of it, it's a community-oriented project targeting local sex workers' needs. It's been a much-cited example over the years of an empowerment approach to HIV prevention. It started in 1992 and was really started to reduce STDs and HIV prevalence among sex workers in the brothels of Sonagachi in Calcutta by using sex workers as peer educators. But the success of the project was actually attributed to the active participation of the sex workers in the design and the implementation of the intervention. So they were actually managers of the intervention, and they were the agents of change, and they set the agenda. So they were often the ones who would say that this is more important to do than the other, rather than it being imposed on them from the top. And it is widely regarded as achieving dramatic HIV success, HIV prevention success. And according to one study, HIV prevalence of 10% was measured in the group that participated compared to rates of 50 to 90% of HIV prevalence among sex workers in other large Indian cities. And condom use apparently rose from 3% among those sex workers to 90%. So it's a much cited example, and it's one more of the empowerment model. So that's the framework of different levels of response to gender inequality as a structural barrier. But ultimately, adopting a structural approach to addressing gender inequality is dependent on certain fundamental principles. The first is that structural approaches are context-specific, and therefore the exact set of activities to be undertaken must be determined by analysis of the local situation and the way in which different factors intersect in that context to create conditions of risk and vulnerability. In other words, and this is what's disappointing to policymakers and to program experts, especially those who've been trained in the biomedical side, It is practically impossible to provide a single blueprint or an exhaustive list of activities necessary to deal with gender and sexual norms across different settings. A fundamental flaw when learning from a structurally oriented approach is to try to copy the activities undertaken in one setting and apply them in other environments. Microfinance, for example, has been shown to work in reducing women's HIV risk in some settings, but not in others. In differing contexts, the microfinance actually can increase women's risk because it provides more money in their hands, it expands their social networks. So there's some analysis to show, whereas in some settings it's protective because of the presence of other interventions, in others by itself, it can actually increase women's risk. Secondly, because there are typically multiple gender-related factors in any context that contribute to women's vulnerability, changing gender roles and norms requires multiple structural activities implemented simultaneously. It also requires those structural activities to occur simultaneously with the provision of the traditional package of HIV prevention and treatment services. So we are now calling it combination programming, like we talk about combination treatment. Combination prevention is what we are saying now. This is not easy because it requires multiple implementers to coordinate their programs. It requires integration and collaboration so that multiple activities, structural, behavioral, and biomedical, are implemented simultaneously. The success of Uganda in reducing HIV incidence in the early 2000s is an example, in fact, of combination prevention. A recent analysis by Elaine Murphy and Meg Green, who used to be here at GW, of conditions that led to the success of Uganda's prevention efforts highlights that it was because the behavior change was occurring, the behavior change programs were occurring in a context of extensive social mobilization at every level, with leaders at every level speaking up about it. Museveni, the president of Uganda, spoke from his podium about fidelity, called upon men in particular to change their behavior, encourage mutual respect between spouses, and simultaneously, women's groups in the country played a key role in mobilizing and publicizing women's vulnerabilities. A Ministry of Women's Affairs was created at the time. The number of women in parliament increased. So there's a bunch of things that simultaneously happen that don't get talked about. And yet we are convinced that all of those things have to happen in order for change to be brought about. And thirdly, processes that catalyze community ownership and participation facilitate more sustainable changes in gender-related or other social norms. So you can't just, you know, top-down approaches, there are structural approaches that are top-down that do work well, but for the most part, if you want to create changes in normative behavior, so Nagachi is a case in point, you need to sort of have it happen through community organic processes. So ultimately, implementing a structural approach to prevention, whether to address gender inequality or some other structural factor, involves taking steps to know the dynamics in the local environment, identifying the risk behavior of interest, mapping the direct structural drivers of risk and the broader structures that influence vulnerability, and then determining the potential areas of action. This mapping to know the potential causal pathways of risk and vulnerability can help to focus attention to particular locally specific levels of risk and vulnerability. Because I've heard people say, what we need is comprehensive programming. We need to do it all. It's not going to happen. There are no resources to do that. It's not very effective to do that. So you have to be able to argue for why you want several things to occur simultaneously. And just as one example, a broad structural approach to address transactional sex, for example, in a poor community may be to address food insecurity, but that approach will only be effective in those communities where poverty and food insecurity are linked and where the response to food insecurity is transactional sex. In other poor communities where transactional sex is occurring between school or college girls and sugar daddies, the structural approach may be to provide educational subsidies. So what you do depends upon the causal pathways. So mapping those links is necessary to address the broader structural factors. So the promotion of a structural approach to HIV prevention has been thwarted by the lack of proof. It's the lack of evaluation data, the lack of being able to show that it works. And I want to just say that the gold standard of evaluation evidence between public health that is generated through randomized control trials is limited in its scope to evaluate responses or interventions that cannot show such an immediate proximal cause and effect relationship. When factors more distally affect an outcome, they go through several pathways, and it's very, very complicated and extremely expensive, as the image project showed, to conduct a randomized controlled trial in those kinds of settings. So we are now calling for anything that is being scaled up. For example, in India, Gates Foundation is scaling up HIV prevention efforts all over southern India, that we should add an evaluation component to that, add structural approaches, and use that setting instead of having separate monies being put aside for, you know, really complicated and expensive randomized controlled trials for structural factors, because you can't in any case do those structural interventions alone. You need to do everything else. So these examples point clearly, I mean, the Image Project is one, and many others that have tried to do this and have had a heck of a time and now get criticized for their methodology being weak because they couldn't make it work in a natural setting. So it calls also for an innovation and evaluation. If it is accepted that structural factors are critically important and our current evaluation methodologies do not lend themselves adequately to measure the impact, then newer methodologies need to be adopted. And we are right now looking at a stepped wedge design, trial design, to try and see if it can fill that gap, though there is no systematic review of using this methodology for structural approaches. So in order to truly move the field forward, we need a radical departure from standard epidemiological orthodoxy. We need to accept that only certain types of responses are amenable to evaluation, demonstrating direct cause and effect impact, where HIV incidence is the outcome indicator. So in conclusion, let me say that there is no doubt that there are many difficulties in operationalizing a structural approach. Yet just because something is difficult does not mean it should not be done. Indeed, many would argue that the failure of HIV prevention internationally to show consistent or sustained HIV incidence reduction may be because we have not been doing it right, because we have shied away from the difficulty involved in engaging with broader, more distal and contextual drivers of HIV vulnerability and risk. Structural interventions, particularly on more distal levels of influence, cannot easily show cause and effect relationships. It is hard to count direct outcomes and hard to claim with certainty that they were driven by the intervention alone. This must not prevent a structural approach from being taken because we know these are good things to do anyway for overall development. If it does hold structural approaches behind, ubiquitous structural barriers like gender inequality will continue to fuel the spread of HIV infection. So I think the time has now come to direct resources to the implementation and creative evaluation and gathering of evidence and experience on the use of structural approaches on a much larger scale. Thank you very much. I went a little over, but I'm happy to take questions. Or comments, yes. In response to your comment, I want to share with you that there's currently an international initiative called AIDS 2031 that has been launched by Peter Piot, the current head of UNAIDS. And that initiative is experts from around the world who are thinking about where do we want to be 50 years from the start of the AIDS epidemic, which would be 2031. And if we want to be in a different place from where we are today, 25 years into the epidemic, then we need to be doing something differently now. And a big emphasis in that is on prevention, and is on prevention with young people, and trying to figure out what are the dynamics now. And I think you're absolutely right that it's a different generation because it's grown up in a different time. It's also a generation globally that's in many, many countries has grown up in a time of conflict and a time of war, and the internally displaced people, young people, and you know, young people who have migrated. So it's an entirely different context, and we are just beginning to think about what are the implications of that. For gender equality, I'll tell you, there is no data that I can refer to in terms of how it's different now from what it used to be. But I can anecdotally tell you from my colleagues who travel in Africa that there is a perverse and peculiar thing that's happening now, which is that all of our emphasis on women's empowerment and programs where investments are made in women is creating a generation of very angry young men. They're young men who are struggling to get employment in very difficult circumstances, who feel that they are being pointed to as the perpetrators, who are, you know, of everything that's gone wrong in Africa, and feel extremely alienated and from society. And then when we go in, as we're here to empower women, you know, it's like, but what about us? What have you done to us? And I share that with you because, you know, we used to say that our field of work was women in development. No longer do we say that. We say gender and development. And I stayed away, only because of time constraints, from all that we know about the way in which gender affects boys and men. But it is as debilitating to them to have these norms imposed on them and expectations that they will behave a particular way. And what's really interesting is that both girls and boys of that age group increasingly want to be different. They're exposed to much more through the media now. And so I just say this anecdotally, but I don't know this through scientific fact. But, you know, MTV is in the poorest slums in Bombay. And so on the one hand, sexuality is in your face. But on the other hand, they see different relationships between women and men and between boys and girls, some of which are terribly regressive and horrible, and some of which are very progressive. And so I don't know what the impact of all of that will be. And we've actually got youth leaders working with us on AIDS 2031 to provide some of that perspective. Yes.
I wanted to follow up on that point also from the debate. That is that over time, there are influences on, and multiple influences on any given health outcome. And there's no way to evaluate the influence of the fact. So things like the internet, things like MTV, whatever it is, have an impact, positive or negative. We have no way of evaluating the actual impact. So looking forward, how can we develop evaluation systems that take into account things that we can't manage?
Well, sociological analysis does look at stuff like that. I mean, there are studies that look at the impact of media and TV and electronic stuff on societies and how it shifts patterns of behavior. So it's not that it doesn't exist, it's just we don't draw from it to design our health interventions. And that's the other piece that in AIDS 2031 we're trying to shift. So it's not AIDS experts alone who are part of AIDS 2031. It's political scientists and social geographers and, you know, a whole bunch of other people from other fields who've done this better than us, who know, understand things that we're trying to cope with, and we just don't have the knowledge base or the expertise to be able to lend to these new issues. You know, smoking is the classic example. How did smoking behavior change happen? Now, that's within public health, but even that's not applied to AIDS.
Any more questions? Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.